3. Barking fish. A year after going to Wayland Smithy, I joined 30 other people at sunrise of a very cold spring day to hear birds singing the dawn chorus at the Yorkshire Sculpture Park in England. Our guide, Duncan, was a typical bluff and taciturn Yorkshireman who was not going to waste 10 words where one would do. "How do you know that's a great tit?" I asked. "You just know. Years of listening and watching," was the straight answer. We stood among the trees and sculptures, with bluebells lighting up the undergrowth, all being brought to life by rays of early morning sun, and just listened. As Duncan might have said, we had signed up for a dawn chorus walk, and listening to birds was all we were going to do. First, I took in the general soundscape. Since it was spring, the birds were in full voice, with songs surrounding us from all sides. Duncan was right not to give us expansive descriptions, because being forced to stand and just listen was revelatory, bringing home to me the sheer complexity of the dawn chorus. I tried estimating how many birds were singing and where the sounds were coming from. I tried to pick out individual calls, like a conductor listening for a particular orchestral instrument. In the distance, there was the honking of noisy geese from the lake at the bottom of the hill. They seemed to be constantly screaming. Higher up the slope was the occasional cooing of wood pigeons. In the direction of a rusting sculpture, rooks were cawing their signature call. And all around, songbirds were tweeting and warbling. I picked out one bird singing a powerful short cascade of notes. Duncan identified it as a robin. Now, robins visit my garden all the time, but I had never realized how rich their song is. Chiffchaffs, nuthatches, and chaffinches. How could I have overlooked the diversity of this natural orchestra and just lumped all these instrumentalists into one big category labeled birdsong? The scientific literature on noise extends even less consideration to individual creatures. A single category contains not only bird calls, but also every other natural sound. And there are only two categories, natural and unnatural. Common sense holds that natural things are good for our health and to be encouraged, and unnatural sounds are harmful and to be abated. But this is an oversimplification that researchers such as Eleanor Ratcliffe, an environmental psychologist from the University of Surrey, are starting to pick apart. Eleanor is researching people's responses to birdsong. In a survey, she found that although birdsong was the most commonly mentioned natural sound, in about a quarter of the responses she read it was unwelcome. For instance, one person complained about the unpleasant, raucous, cackling cry of magpies, partly because magpies have been unfairly blamed for there being fewer songbirds nowadays. Eleanor has been running other experiments to see whether more pleasant bird calls may be better than others in helping people de-stress. In one test, the call of a small olive-green forest bird from New Zealand, the silver eye, was rated as most likely to help people relax and recover from mental fatigue. The silver eye sings an archetypal pretty songbird warble. In contrast, the ugly screech of a jay was rated as less helpful for stress and mental fatigue. Animal calls are at the heart of our relationship with the natural world. The sounds of insects, birds, and other animals are parts of our memories, evocative of time, place, and season. For me, the croaky "ah!" of a rook immediately conjures up images of a churchyard in an English village at twilight, where the birds are settling down to roost. The rhythmic buzz of crickets brings back fond memories of balmy evenings camping in the south of France. When I hear the horrible scream of foxes in heat, I remember waking up once with a start, convinced that a baby was being murdered outside my bedroom window. Many natural sounds are unpleasant, like the fox's cry, but could some of these ugly calls be good for us? Documentary directors portray the natural world as though vision is the only important sense. Sadly, in natural history television programs, the wildlife sounds are virtually inaudible. Instrumental mood music and pictures dominate. I asked natural history sound recordist Chris Watson about this. If you have seen any recent BBC natural history programs, chances are that Chris recorded some of the wildlife. In his soft, northern English drawl, he explained to me that the music is slapped on to manipulate mood. It's so badly done. It's so omnipresent and intrusive It's like being injected with steroids. But this playing down of natural sound is artificial. How often have you heard wildlife you did not see, because it was difficult to spot or hidden from view? And how did that sound make you feel? This may not come as a great shock, but science seems to demonstrate that nature is largely good for us. One well-known study showed that patients after gallbladder surgery were discharged from the hospital sooner if their bed had a view out of a window rather than facing a brick wall. Laboratory studies have shown that exposure to nature aids recovery from mental fatigue. Psychologist Mark Berman and collaborators assessed their subjects' mental abilities, for example, by getting them to remember and recount a sequence of digits in reverse order. The subjects then went for a walk in a park or in downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan. After the break, the subjects were retested, and those who had experienced nature outperformed those who had gone downtown. Nature can also aid recovery from stress. Roger Ulrich and collaborators examined the responses of 120 undergraduate volunteers as they watched a couple of videos. All of the students watched the same first video, which was designed to create stress, depicting accidents in a woodworking shop and including serious injuries, simulated blood, and mutilation. For the second video, half of the students viewed a depiction of a natural setting and the other half viewed an urban setting. During this second video, the students were asked to rate their affective state while researchers took physiological measurements to gauge how much they were sweating. The students who watched the nature movie recovered more quickly from the stress induced by the accident video than did those who watched the urban recovery film. Unfortunately, very few studies in this field have focused on the role of acoustics. One rare exception is the study by Jesper Alvarsson and colleagues. They stressed 40 people with tricky mental arithmetic tasks. They then allowed the subjects to recover while listening to recordings such as fountains and tweeting birds, or traffic noise, to see how different sounds changed stress recovery. Results were inconclusive, however. Only one of the physiological measures, the amount of sweating, responded positively to the natural sounds. There are three competing theories as to why nature might be good for us. The first is evolutionary. It suggests that a preference for natural things evolved to encourage us to seek out fertile natural environments where we could find food. The second is psychological and suggests that nature stops us from being too self-absorbed and having negative thoughts, by giving us a sense of belonging to something greater than oneself. The third theory says that restorative natural places have soft fascination, meaning that there are captivating yet calming features to look at, such as clouds, sunsets, and the motion of leaves in a breeze, and that this soft fascination helps achieve cognitive quiet. These theories can help explain our reactions to natural sounds that are aesthetically pleasing. But what about those that aren't? Watching westerns as a child, I always felt that the rhythmic chirring of crickets was ridiculously loud. How could the cowboys sleep with that racket going on? It seemed unbelievable that such a small insect could make such a loud sound. I got the opportunity to ask some top sound people from Hollywood about this one sunny afternoon, as we sipped margaritas alongside a clear blue swimming pool in Los Angeles. Myron Nettinger is an Academy Award-winning sound mixer and designer. Gregarious, enthusiastic, and fixed with a permanent smile, he explained that insects really are that loud in the Midwestern U.S. But what he said next is what really grabbed my attention. In choosing a cricket to accompany the cowboys eating beans around the fire, a sound designer does not pick out any old recording, but must find the one that portrays the right mood to accent the film's emotional narrative. Myron explained that for a scene about a lazy, calm night in the country, he might pick a soothing cricket. But hey man, if a guy is creeping around the back of the house looking to jump some people, then all of a sudden there's a cricket and he's agitated and he's a little nervous and he's stopping and starting. Myron's choice depends on the rhythm of the cricket chirrs and the abruptness with which each sound starts. While cricket calls vary between species, the various buzzes and chirps all start with stridulation, in which the insect rubs its body parts together. The snowy tree cricket sounds like a quiet trill phone as it rubs its wings together in a rapid scissoring action, swiping a hardened scraper from one wing against the stridulatory file, a structure that looks like a saw blade when magnified under an electron microscope, on the other wing. It is like a tiny version of a scraper percussion instrument you might have played in elementary school. Every time the cricket's scraper hits one of the teeth of the stridulatory file, a small impulsive sound is made. The pitch of the trill depends on how fast the scraper is pulled past the teeth. Typically, a tooth on the stridulatory file is hit by the scraper every half millisecond, creating a frequency of 2,000 Hz, a typical pitch for someone whistling. In a recording I have of a snowy tree cricket, the insect draws the wings across each other 8 times before pausing for about a third of a second and then doing it again. The snowy tree cricket is nicknamed the temperature cricket because its call speeds up as the insect gets hotter. You can estimate the temperature in Fahrenheit by counting the number of chirps that happen in a quarter of a minute and then adding 40. Given this well-known correlation between temperature and rhythm, sound designers like Myron might choose a slower chirping, colder cricket to evoke calm, even if the film scene depicts a warmer, lazier night. A hotter cricket sounds more urgent, like a trill phone that demands to be answered, with the chirps closer together and starting more abruptly. On its own, the stridulation does not make a very loud sound, but each tiny impulsive vibration causes parts of the wing to resonate and amplify the sound. This is similar to how a violin works. The bow vibrates a violin string, which is very quiet on its own. But the string's vibration travels through the instrument's bridge to the wooden body, which has a large surface area and radiates a much louder sound. The periodic cicada, another insect that uses stridulation, sounds more like a bird than any insect. The cicada's slow, two-tone call starts with an unpleasant, high-pitched screech that lasts a couple of seconds, before the frequency drops by about an octave, down to a lower, breathy note. The cicada makes short impulses by rapid muscle movements that deform and release timbal membranes underneath the folded wings, a bit like deforming an aluminum can with your finger. The clicks created when the membrane deforms or pops back are amplified by the resonance of air in the insect's abdominal cavity. While the cicada's dissonant call is terrifying in its own way, I suspect the call is too unusual for sound designers. If you are trying to pull people in and make them feel as though they are really in a film scene, sounds must not be so unusual that they draw attention to themselves. As Myron put it, you don't want to let them see the magician behind the mirrors. You want to make it seem that they're there. In Bowie, Maryland, near Washington, D.C., ash trees filled with a brood of male cicadas can exceed 90 decibels, well above safe workplace levels. Such dense congregation of cicadas happens only every 17 years because of the cicada's long life cycle. The biggest and most common cicada in the Maryland brood was Magicicada septendecim, which, according to a report in a local paper, sounds like a giant weed whacker or sci-fi spaceship. The loudest cicada in the trees was another species, Magicicada cassini, which produces a harsh screeching noise like the sound of a million baby rattles. Famous ocean explorer Jacques Cousteau might have celebrated the silent world back in the 1950s, but actually the underwater environment is far from quiet. Water boatman Micronectar schultzi use stridulation to make calls that sound like the rhythmic churring of crickets. Micronectar schultzi is said to be the loudest aquatic animal relative to its body length. Though only a few millimeters, about a tenth of an inch long, it can be audible from a riverbank. The discovery that the insect rubs a ridge on its penis against corrugations on its abdomen to initiate the sound made headlines, a rare tabloid triumph for entomological anatomy. Some water boatmen use the resonance of the air within the bubble they carry around for breathing to amplify their calls. They do this by closely matching the frequency of their body vibrations to the bubble's resonant frequency. As the air bubble shrinks, the resonant frequency rises, and the water boatman needs to stridulate faster. Snapping shrimp also use bubbles to help make their sound. Sometimes for communication, but at other times to kill their prey. The method of making the sound is remarkable because it does not come from the claws tapping each other. In 2000, Michel Verslaus from the University of Twente in the Netherlands and collaborators used high-speed video to reveal the secret. The shrimp closes its claws very rapidly, with the tips moving at 70 kilometers, about 45 miles per hour, creating a jet of fast-moving water. Following Bernoulli's principle, the pressure drops in the rapidly moving water, low enough for the water to start boiling at sea temperature. A bubble of water vapor forms, which immediately collapses and creates a shock wave that stuns or kills prey. Light is also made in a process nicknamed shrimpoluminescence. Large colonies of snapping shrimp create a noise like the crackling from a roaring fire. Chris Watson reckons this must be the most common animal sound on our planet, yet it is a sound that not that many people get to hear. The shrimp also pose problems for natural history recordists. I was trying to record the voice and song of the blue whale off the north coast of Iceland, the largest and loudest animal that has ever lived, Chris told me. And alongside that, at times I couldn't hear the blue whales at a distance because of the snap, crackle and pop of these animals, which are a couple of centimeters long. This problem is familiar to the military. The study of snapping shrimps began in World War II because the noise was interfering with efforts to hear enemy submarines. It seems odd that tiny, vulnerable animals draw attention to themselves by making so much noise. The Victorian missionary and explorer David Livingstone wrote on a trip to Africa, "The stridulous, piercing notes of the cicadae are perfectly deafening. A drab-coloured cricket joins the chorus with a sharp sound, which has as little modulation as the drone of a Scottish bagpipe. I could not conceive how so small a thing could raise such a sound. It seemed to make the ground over it thrill." Perhaps he heard the African cicada. This is the loudest insect, reaching 101 decibels, 1 meter, about 3 feet away, as noisy as a pneumatic drill. But cicadas are not the only incredibly loud chorusing animals. David Livingstone reported, "When cicadae, crickets, and frogs unite, their music may be heard at the distance of a quarter of a mile. Frogs are meant to go croak, but someone failed to pass along this information to the amphibians in Hong Kong Park. Built on a former army barracks site in Central District, the park gives respite from one of the most densely populated cities in the world. When I visited in 2009, the frogs in the park made squelching chatter like a poor impersonation of Donald Duck. Frogs mostly call with their mouths shut, their vocal sacs swelling up beneath the mouth like a giant bubblegum bubble. Frogs do not breathe out when calling for a mate. They circulate the air from lungs to mouth to vocal sac, with the sound escaping via vibrations of their head, vocal sac, and other body parts. Like humans, frogs have a pair of vocal folds that open and close as the air rushes by, breaking up the constant flow of air into pressure pulses that form sound. Humans amplify their voice using the resonances of the air in their vocal tract, the mouth, nose, and air cavity at the top of the throat. But in frogs, the amplifying resonance comes from the skin of the vocal sac. If a human talks after breathing in helium, the change to a lighter gas in the vocal tract shifts the resonances up in frequency, producing a funny, squeaky voice. Get a frog to inhale helium, as some scientists have done, and the call is largely unaltered. Evidence that the resonance of the air in the frog's vocal sac is not what amplifies the calls. Rather than imperiling the community, the communal racket creates an evolutionary defense. While bigger frog choirs attract a few more predators, they also attract a lot more females. Each individual frog is less likely to die, and more likely to find a mate. When I walked too close to the frogs in Hong Kong Park, the croaking suddenly stopped, with the wave of silence signaling a threat through the froggery. Sound designer Julian Treasure believes that most people find birdsong reassuring, because over hundreds of thousands of years, we have learned that when the birds are singing, everything is okay. It is when the birds go quiet that you need to worry, because it could be a sign that a predator is about. A plausible argument, but not one, I think, that has ever been tested scientifically. This idea has led Julian to use birdsong in some of his sound designs, including as a crime deterrent in Lancaster, California. Loudspeakers looking like small green bollards dot the flower beds along the main shopping street and are meant to play a mix of twinkly electronic music, water movement sounds, and songbirds. Unfortunately, when I visited Lancaster one Sunday afternoon, the day after I met the Hollywood sound designers, the loudspeakers were just pumping out middle-of-the-road country and western music. Not a particularly soothing choice, perhaps, but there is precedent for using music as a crime deterrent. In Australia, the Manilow method uses easy listening tracks to disperse teenagers by making places uncool to hang out in. There is plenty of anecdotal evidence that this tactic works, even though Barry Manilow asked, "Have they thought that the hoodlums might like my music? What if some of them began to sing along with Can't Smile Without You?" There are regular news stories about animal noise disturbances. It is difficult to believe, for example, that people complaining about their neighbour's rooster find this natural sound restorative. While loud animal calls are thrilling to listen to, these sounds overload our auditory system, prevent us from hearing other signs of danger, and can even trigger an early warning system that puts us on alert. Familiarity plays an important role in our response to all sounds, including animal calls. Andrew Whitehouse, from Aberdeen University in Scotland, has been researching the relationship between birds and people, specifically the effect of birdsong. Early on, the media picked up on his research, prompting people to write to him with their personal stories, which produced a goldmine of data for an anthropologist. Take the following story sent to Andrew from someone who had moved from the UK to Australia. The Australian birdsong is really quite disruptive. We have heard of people emigrating back to the UK because of the ugly birdsong here. In a nutshell, I would describe the subconscious effect of birdsong here as being to raise people's tension. It is a series of screeches or other worldly sounds. There are many stories, like this one, from people who emigrated and were surprised at how much the change in birdsong affected them. Even people who had previously largely ignored natural sounds felt alien because of the bird calls. Unfamiliarity can also be a source of delight, as I found when I visited the dry rainforests in Queensland, Australia a few years ago. The eastern whipbird is named after the sound of its call. The male starts with a sustained whistled note for a couple of seconds before an explosive crescendo on a glissando, which abruptly ends like a whip being cracked, leaving the sound to reverberate through the trees. The starting note is at a high frequency, somewhere in the middle of a piccolo's range, and the glissando sweeps across a wide span of almost 8,000 hertz in just 0.17 seconds, like a piccolo player starting on the lowest note and sweeping through the whole of the instrument's range and beyond. Since the whip cry must be a difficult vocal skill, female whip birds may well use the quality of the performance as a sign of how fit a male is. Sometimes the song turns into a duet as a female responds with a couple of quick syllables, choo-choo. The calls are more common when mates are being chosen, a strong indication that the duets play an important part in forming and maintaining partnerships. Of course, one can hear unexpected bird sounds even in one's home country. Bitterns are reclusive wading birds that, for most of the last century, hovered on the brink of extinction. They're a type of heron that makes the most extraordinary bass sounds, which can carry for many miles over their reed bed habitat. Many scientific papers detail how to count and identify individual bitterns from their calls, because they are very difficult to see but easy to hear. Their call is immensely powerful, at 101 decibels at 1 meter, about a yard away. It has a volume similar to that of a trumpet. And at about 155 hertz, a typical frequency produced by a tuba, the bittern's call is often likened to a distant foghorn. As sound moves through the air, tiny amounts of energy are lost through absorption every time the air molecules vibrate back and forth, and this absorption limits how far the wave can travel. By definition, lower frequency sounds vibrate fewer times than high frequency ones, and thus they lose less energy over long distances and travel much farther than high frequencies. So the bittern's bass booms are effective across the reed beds. A suffocating thick fog hung over Hamwall Wetland Reserve near Glastonbury, England, when I went to hear bitterns one spring morning. We had a very early 5 o'clock start because, like most other birds, bitterns are most vocal at sunrise. My guide was John Drever, who had stuffed his car trunk with strange-shaped microphones, recorders and boom arms. Wearing a flat cap to protect him from the bitter cold, John looked more like a cat burglar than the friendly musician and acoustic ecologist he really is. Once we had parked at the reserve, we staggered down the path to the nesting sites, barely able to see in the dark fog. We eventually stumbled across a bench in a bird blind, sat down, and listened. I first heard the call off to the left, sounding like a distant industrial process starting up, quite unlike any other bird I had previously encountered. In The Hound of the Baskervilles, the villain, Jack Stapleton, tries to fool Sherlock Holmes by suggesting that a deep roar and a melancholy throbbing murmur was a bittern calling and not the hound of hell. Unluckily for Stapleton, a bittern sounds nothing like a dog. The bittern I heard reminded me of someone blowing across a large beer bottle in the pub, or the jug from an old-fashioned jug band. Then a moment later, another bittern to the right joined in at a slightly higher frequency. We moved to another blind, where I was close enough to a bittern to hear the build-up to the call. The bird gulped in air 4 times and then let out 7 clear booms a couple of seconds apart. Exactly what the bittern does to make this call is unknown, for this is a secretive and well-camouflaged animal. Rare video footage shows the extraordinary prelude to the booms, as the bittern's throat swells up and the body convulses while the air is gulped in, looking like a cat preparing to cough up a furball. But then the bird remains almost still as the sound is made. Since the number of bitterns is growing, maybe more observations of the booming will be possible and will solve the mystery. In 1997, there were only 11 booming males in the UK. In 2012, there were at least 100 because of restoration of the reed beds. Scientists have been measuring when the booms are made to try and understand the purpose of the call and whether it relates to breeding success. The fact that the males call before mating implies that the females assess the fitness of competing males by the strength of their booms. Booms are produced during nesting as well, suggesting that they are also used to defend feeding territories. An hour and a half after we arrived, the light grew brighter and the bitterns stopped booming. Frozen to the bone, we headed back to the car. I suddenly became aware of the bedlam from the songbirds twittering around me. I had been concentrating so hard on low-frequency booms that I had tuned out the high-frequency warbling. In this environment, the bittern call could easily be mistaken for a loud human-made noise. For a sound to be restorative, it needs to be unambiguously natural and avoid setting our alert system on edge. If we are familiar with the source or have an expert guide to explain it to us, we can categorize the sound as natural and a non-threat and take comfort in it. A couple of months before the trip to hear bitterns, at a TEDx conference in Salford, England, biologist Heather Whitney talked about how plants evolved to attract pollinators, such as orchids that look and smell like female wasps, to con the males into trying to mate with them and thus spread pollen. It was a great talk, but it was the new acoustic research Heather told me about later in the cafe that really got me excited. One of her colleagues had found plants that evolved leaves specially shaped to attract their pollinators, echolocating bats. Beyond the human hearing range is an extraordinary ultrasonic world. Bats exist in a plane of hearing where nearly all sounds exceed 20,000 Hz, or 20 kilohertz. 1 kilohertz equals 1,000 Hz, the upper threshold of our auditory perception. 3 months after the TEDx event, I joined a group of about 20 people for a bat walk at twilight in the moorland village of Greenmount, England. The meeting point was the parking lot of the local pub. It was not difficult to identify the guide. With pictures of flying mammals on her t-shirt and phone, Claire Sefton personified bubbly bat enthusiasm. A research scientist in a different subject, she goes to academic conferences on bats just for fun and is an amateur veterinarian for bats. Before walking down the Kirklees Valley, she showed us a couple of patients she was nursing back to health. One came from the largest species in the UK, a noctule bat with reddish-brown fur, very cute, like a big mouse with wings. It kept opening its mouth and flashing its teeth. As Claire said, it was having a good look at us, shouting its echolocation signal. The other bat was a tiny common pipistrelle, which, despite having a body only about 4 centimeters, 1.5 inches long, manages to eat 3,000 insects in one night. Since the echolocation calls are at too high a frequency to be heard by humans, we needed some electronic assistance. Claire handed out bat detectors, black boxes about the size of an old brick mobile phone with 2 controls, one marked gain, the other marked frequency. As darkness started to fall, our small group of bat hunters set off down a tree-lined path, clutching the hissing detectors. Near an old railway bridge, my detector spurted out a fast series of clicks, like someone rapidly clapping hands in an erratic rhythm. Pipistrelle, Claire announced, identifying the species from the call pattern. Each click is actually a chirp, a short, sharp yelp descending in frequency. The rate at which chirps are produced changes as a bat approaches an object, to the point where each individual chirp cannot be heard. When this happened, the detector sounded like it was blowing a raspberry. The next day I examined some recordings of a common pipistrelle. The best way to view each chirp was a spectrogram, because it would show how the frequency of the sound changed over the length of the call. More often used to examine speech, the spectrogram is a wonderful tool for visualizing sounds. Dark descending lines illustrate how the frequency dropped from 70 kHz to just under 50 kHz over a short 7 millisecond call. But how could I have heard this call on the bat monitor when the frequency is far too high for my hearing? An ultrasonic microphone on the bat monitor picks up the chirps of the bat, and the detector adjusts the tone to be within human hearing range. Claire was able to identify the bat as a common pipistrelle because each species uses different frequencies to echolocate, producing contrasting sounds from the detector. The noctule bat, for example, produces jazzy, rhythmic lip smacks with a distinct groove. Experts can also tell whether the bat is emerging from its roost, feeding, flying by, or having a chat with a friend from the different sounds of the calls. I find it particularly remarkable that bats do this with basically the same vocal and hearing apparatus that humans have. To make such high-frequency noise, bats have to push the mammalian body to its extremes. Some bat species produce sound at 200 kHz, which means they are opening and closing the gap between their vocal folds 200,000 times a second, although they boast an important modification: thin and light membranes attached to their vocal folds that can vibrate very quickly. Bats not only hit extremely high notes, but they also routinely generate extraordinarily loud calls. The calls might reach 120 decibels, analogous to the sound reaching your ear from a smoke alarm going off just 10 centimeters, 4 inches away. These are levels that can damage a mammalian hearing system, so bat ears have a reflex to protect themselves. Muscles contract when the bat is calling and displace the tiny bones in the middle ear, thereby reducing how much vibration is transmitted from the eardrum to the inner ear. Humans also have this acoustic reflex, but the evolutionary purpose is still being debated. Maybe, as in bats, the reflex protects our hearing against loud sounds. Or maybe it reduces the volume of our own speech so that other sounds are more audible. Leaving the path, we headed through woods toward a small reservoir, stumbling over tree roots as we went. Not taking a flashlight along on a nighttime walk was a mistake. But it was worth blundering through the dark to hear the Daubenton's bats hunting insects just above the water. Their roost was under a gigantic brick bridge, and the bat detectors periodically burst to life, sounding like distant machine gun fire. Armed with a detector, I could appreciate the huge number of bats that lived in the valley. It is astounding that up until then I had been totally unaware of these sounds around me. In a radio interview, sound recordist Chris Watson explained how listening to bats hunting down prey changed his perception of Lake Verney in Wales. The place was actually turned on its head from being this peaceful, tranquil environment to human ears, to being the carnage of a battle above my head in the ultrasonic region. What else aren't we hearing? Mark Holdred, at his laboratory in Bristol University, England, is another bat expert with infectious enthusiasm, who answered my questions so extensively that I almost missed my train home. He explained to me that the bats are not only hearing the insects and each other, they are also listening for sound reflecting from plants. Mark and colleagues had been researching Markgravia evenia, a Cuban vine with a leaf that is especially good at reflecting sound, and so stands out from the rest of the vegetation in the rainforest. The vine has an arching stalk with a ring of flowers at the end. The last leaf on the branch hangs vertically above the flowers and forms a concave hemisphere to reflect a bat's ultrasonic chirps. As a bat flies around the rainforest, it hears a very complicated pattern of reflections from all the vegetation. The echoes shimmer and are continually changing. In contrast, the pattern of sound reflections from the convex vine leaf stays almost the same, no matter what the angle of the bat to the plant. So the vine stands out as the only thing in the rainforest that gives a constant reply to the echolocation signal. Moreover, the hemispherical shape of the leaf focuses and amplifies the echolocation signal so that the bat can hear the plant from farther away. Mark and his collaborators confirmed these acoustic properties with laboratory measurements using a tiny loudspeaker to radiate ultrasound and a microphone to sense the reflections of the leaf. But what evidence suggests that bats take any notice of the reflections from the leaf? By training bats to search for a feeder in a laboratory full of artificial foliage, the researchers demonstrated that the animals found food twice as fast when the hemispherical leaf was in place. In the rainforest, the vine increases its chances of being pollinated by attracting bats with its concave leaf. In exchange, the flying mammals get nectar. In Mark's laboratory, there was a set of dried moth samples, some with extravagantly long tails. Like the vine, these moths have changed because of bats using echolocation. Some moths have evolved high-frequency hearing solely to listen for predator bats. The long moth tails are ultrasonic decoys. A fighter jet can drag a decoy behind it to lure radar-controlled missiles away from the plane. Similarly, a moth sacrifices a decoy tail to protect itself from the bats. The yellow Madagascar moon moth in Mark's laboratory had two swallowtails, each six times the length of the main body. The tails ended in twists, and Mark's measurements show that this means the tails very effectively reflect the bat's calls from all directions, mimicking the ultrasound reflections from the wings of a smaller moth. Mark has shown that 70% of the time the bat attacks a streamer tail rather than the insect's body, the moth loses its tail, but lives. Wildlife recordist Chris Watson describes the oceans as the most sound-rich environment on the planet, adding, "Arrogantly, we think we're on planet Earth, and of course we aren't. We live on planet ocean. 70% of the planet is ocean." To illustrate his point, Chris told me about an expedition to the Arctic, where, off the coast of the island of Spitsbergen in the Svalbard archipelago, he had encountered bearded seals singing underneath thick sea ice. He lowered hydrophones, underwater microphones, through the ice holes made by the seals into the still, inky blackness of the water. To Chris, the seal calls were mesmerizing to listen to because they appeared to be from another planet. It's almost beyond description. To use lots of cliched terms, it sounds like a choir of alien angels. The seals make long, drawn-out glissandos lasting many tens of seconds. I could do a great impersonation with a swanee slide whistle by gradually pulling out the plunger. It seems that longer glissandos are more appealing to females, so length of call matters. Chris's vivid description of aquatic acoustics made me want to experience these wonders firsthand, which I managed a month after my bat expedition. On a cold, wet and windy day, I boarded a small boat with a dozen other passengers also swathed in rain gear, clutching a hydrophone and a sound recorder. We were on a trip around the Cromarty Firth in Scotland to meet the resident bottlenose dolphins. The Cromarty Firth is quite industrialized, and we started by cruising around the gigantic yellow rusting legs of an oil rig. In the distance, two other platforms were being repaired, and a cruise liner was moored alongside so that her passengers could hunt for Nessie in nearby Loch Ness. But the dolphins were being as elusive as the fabled monster. We left the Cromarty Firth and entered the larger North Sea inlet of the Moray Firth. We were close to cliffs flecked with smelly white guano from the seabirds, with green slopes above lit up by swatches of yellow flowering gorse. Then the skipper, Sarah, caught sight of a dolphin doing an arching jump out of the water. The engine was switched off to silence its rumble, and I lowered the hydrophone over the side. Initially, all I could hear was the slap of the water on the boat's hull as it bobbed up and down on the swell. Then I heard it. A high-pitched, rapid succession of clicks like a tiny toy motorbike revving up, almost inaudible against the water noise. Next, we saw a mother and her calf. The baby dolphin was smaller and a light grey. My thrills were out of sync with the rest of the passengers, as I was the only person with a hydrophone. My fellow passengers were using their eyes to look for dolphins, calling out with excitement whenever one leaped out of the water. But I needed the dolphins to be below the surface for my hydrophones. There was a visual delight having the dolphins so close that I could look them in the eye. But the sound was also magical, because it revealed a little of the underwater world hidden from my fellow passengers. Unfortunately, human-made noise is forcing animals to change their calls, including underwater mammals and fish. Are offshore wind farms an environmentally friendly way to make electricity? Possibly not if you're a harbor seal being bombarded with thumping pile driving as the turbines are installed in the seabed. The number of seals counted on the rocks near Great Yarmouth in England declined during the construction of the Scroby Sands offshore wind farm. The noise generated by pile driving is huge, about 250 decibels at 1 meter, 3 feet, and could physically damage the auditory systems of animals. In March 2000, there was a mass stranding of a dolphin and 16 whales in the Bahamas that is widely believed to have been caused by US Navy sonar. Scientists dispute how loud sonar causes strandings. The noise may simply cause the whales to swim away, alter their dive patterns, and suffer decompression sickness. Alternatively, the sound waves could cause hemorrhaging. But conclusively proving that naval sonar causes strandings is problematic, because navies are reluctant to say when and where they are using sonar. A press release published by the environmental lobby group, the Natural Resources Defense Council, in October 2005 stated, "Mid-frequency sonar can emit continuous sound well above 235 decibels, an intensity roughly comparable to a Saturn V rocket at blastoff. While data show the Saturn V rocket producing 235 decibels, numerically the same as the Navy's sonar, the comparison is inapt because of the difference between airborne and aquatic decibels. Similarly, the 250 decibels created underwater by pile driving for wind farms is not the same as 250 decibels in air. The decibel is always relative to a reference pressure at which you get 0 decibels. In air, the reference is the threshold of hearing at 1,000 hertz for a healthy young adult. Underwater, the reference pressure is smaller. It is similar to the differences between Celsius and Fahrenheit temperature scales, where 0 degrees Celsius is the freezing point of water, but 0 degrees Fahrenheit is much colder. In addition, when comparing airborne and underwater acoustics, the differences in the density and speed of sound in air and water must be considered. To account for these factors, acousticians subtract 61.5 decibels from underwater measurements to get an equivalent airborne value. Thus, 235 decibels underwater is akin to 173.5 decibels on dry land. In 2008, the New York Times described naval sonar as being as loud as 2,000 jet engines, a gross overestimation. The sound 1 meter, about 3 feet away from a sonar, is about as loud as a single jet engine 30 meters, about 100 feet away. Not quiet, but by no means as loud as an entire Air Force squadron. Although some of the decibel analogies are dodgy, the gist of the stories about underwater noise causing harm is correct. Many experts are worried because virtually every aquatic animal uses sound as its main way of communicating. Vision is effective only at short distances underwater. Migrating baleen whales can swim more than 100 kilometers, 60 miles in a day, so they need to chat with others in their pod over long distances. Blue whales can be heard from 1,600 kilometers, 1,000 miles away. Whales achieve such long-distance communication by sending out calls at very low frequency, which are much more efficiently transmitted through seawater than our high-frequency vocalizations. Sudden loud events like naval sonar are not the only sounds that affect marine wildlife. There is chronic shipping noise. In the northeastern Pacific Ocean, shipping noise increased by approximately 19 decibels from 1950 to 2007. This ever-present din could damage aquatic life. It overlaps the frequencies that whales use to communicate, changing vocal patterns. They sing longer, call louder, or move elsewhere. Often whales simply stop communicating, which is a reasonable reaction to short-lived natural sounds like storms, but not to perpetual shipping noise. Unfortunately, while shipping creates a background cacophony, the noise does not project forward of a ship's bow, which can lead to collisions because whales do not hear boats approaching. A piece of ingenious scientific opportunism by Rosalind Rowland of the New England Aquarium in Boston and colleagues demonstrated a physiological effect of chronic noise on whales. Rowland's group took advantage of a lull in shipping traffic following the 9/11 terrorist attacks to see how the North Atlantic right whale population in the Bay of Fundy, Canada, was affected. They monitored whale stress hormones, using sniffer dogs to find floating feces to analyze. After 9/11, the shipping noise reduced by 6 decibels, and Rowland measured a corresponding drop in the whale's stress hormones. Trying to determine the long-term effects of this chronic noise exposure on sea creatures is difficult. Bombard fish with loud noise in a tank and they will move away. This reaction suggests that noise might displace fish populations from breeding and spawning grounds, and obscure the communication between animals needed for finding mates, navigating, and maintaining social groups. But what scientists are grappling with is how to measure any harm, when the effects might take years to become apparent, and aquatic life can move vast distances. Where does aesthetics fit into whether a natural sound is good for us? In China and Japan, crickets and other insects used to be kept as pets because of their beautiful sounds. In the Song Dynasty, AD 960 to 1279, they were the original portable music player. In the introduction of her book on insect musicians, Lisa Ryan writes, "Fashionable people were never without chirping crickets concealed under robes. Rather than pressing a shuffle button, cricket owners used a tickler to stir the insects and make them perform. For me, however, insects are best heard in choruses, especially when the sound can be embellished by the acoustic of a forest. Chris Watson told me about hearing such choruses in the Congo rainforest in Africa. As the temperature drops at sunset, hundreds, possibly thousands, of species contribute to what he described as an amazing chorus of sound which just rolls out like a wave from the forest. They create a rich musicality, a Phil Spector wall of sound, that within an hour is gone." Chris's best recordings come from sweet spots where any individual insect is not too prominent and the sound percolates through the acoustic of the environment. The forest changes the calls, and animals have to adapt in response, to compensate for the distortion created by their surroundings. As sound moves through trees, it bounces off trunks and branches. So, in addition to the direct sound propagating straight from the calling animal, are delayed versions that have reflected off the trees. The similarity between the acoustic of a forest and that of a room has led to scientific papers with titles such as Rainforests as Concert Halls for Birds. Recently, walking around lakes and forests in Germany, I tested this out for myself. I noticed how the acoustic changed as I left the open meadows and entered the conifer forest. And when no one was nearby, I shouted and listened to the sound reflecting back from the trees. The reverberation time in a forest has been measured at about 1.7 seconds, quite similar to that of a concert hall for Baroque music. Forests transmit bass more easily than treble because at high frequency, foliage absorbs sound. This could explain why rainforest birds tend to produce low-frequency songs with drawn-out simple notes. Not only does this form of sound avoid attenuation by the foliage, but the reflections from the trunks amplify the sound of the notes in the same way that room reflections embellish orchestral music. When I shouted in the wood in Germany, I noticed this amplification, but it is subtle because reflections from trees are not as strong as those from the walls of a concert hall. There is also evidence that birds adapt their singing as their surroundings change. Evolutionary biologist Elizabeth Derryberry examined changes in the calls of male white-crowned sparrows during the last 35 years, using historical and contemporary recordings from California. In places where foliage has become heavier over the decades, she found that the song pitch has dropped and the birds now sing more slowly. In contrast, the songs remain unaltered in the one area where the foliage has not changed. Forests are not the only determining factor for birdsong. The most extensive research into chronic noise has investigated how birds deal with the rumble of traffic. Great tits in cities such as London, Paris, and Berlin sing faster and higher in pitch compared with those living in forests. Urban nightingales sing louder when there is traffic, and robins now sing more at night when it is quieter. For great tits, low-frequency singing is important to demonstrate the fitness of males because bigger, healthier birds can sing lower tunes, but their songs can be drowned out by traffic noise. As Hans Slabbercorn from Leiden University in the Netherlands puts it, there is a trade-off between being heard or being loved. There are fears that noise changes the balance of species, and consequently the songs we hear in cities. It has been suggested that there are fewer house sparrows because they are unable to adapt their songs to the urban din. The adaptation of song to habitat could be one way that birds develop their own dialects. As humans learn to speak, they pick up an accent as they hear other people talk. Similarly, some bird species learn songs by imitation and so can be influenced by their neighbors singing. The three-wattled bellbird has different dialects in Central America. One, heard in the northern half of Costa Rica, contains loud bonks and whistles. In contrast, the calls from southern Costa Rica and northern Panama contain loud rasping quacks. Bird dialects have been extensively studied, not least because they give insight into evolution and how species develop. If the songs of neighboring bird colonies diverge, say because of changing habitats, then eventually they will stop communicating and mating with each other. Once that happens, their genes will no longer mix, which means the colonies will start going down different evolutionary paths and potentially form different species. The nightingale is a plain-looking bird, but its singing is commonly cited as among the most beautiful in Europe. Listen to a few recordings of a nightingale, and you will notice how many different songs the male can produce. Because they live in thickets, the large vocal repertoire is a more effective display of prowess than is something visual. In 1773, English lawyer, antiquarian, and naturalist Daines Barrington put the nightingale as top of his pops, based on scoring different British birds for their sprightly notes, mellowness of tone, plaintive notes, compass, and execution. A duet between acclaimed cellist Beatrice Harrison and a nightingale was the very first live outside broadcast on BBC Radio in 1924. The nightingales in the woods around Harrison's home in Oxted, England, had taken to echoing her cello practice. The broadcast was almost a failure, however, because the birds were initially microphone shy. But they did eventually sing, and the program was so popular it was repeated for the next 12 years, and became internationally renowned. The nightingale has a beautiful song, which means it is a potentially restorative sound. However, our response to animal calls goes beyond oral aesthetics. When people wrote to Andrew Whitehouse about their experiences of birdsong, the iconic nightingale and its wonderful warbling rarely appeared in the stories. People more often wrote about the stuttering long cry of herring gulls in seaside towns, or the excited screeching from flocks of swifts. Sometimes these calls brought back childhood memories. A common gull just this moment cried outside my room window. My instant response to that is clear pictures of mast trawlers at Point Law, Pint Lar, where I spent school holidays, or songs that signified the seasons. The bird song I love the best is the scream of the swift, because of its associations with summer. Thus, the natural sounds most likely to be restorative and best for our health are those that are familiar and bring back happy memories. When I asked Chris Watson for his favorite sound, he did not choose something exotic from his recording trips around the world. Instead, he described the complex, rich, and fruity song of the blackbird, something he could hear in his back garden. Hearing nature is different from viewing it, however, so we need new theories to explain which sounds are good for us and why. I enjoy hearing the sound of ducks, not because I think quacks are especially beautiful, but because the sound brings back fond memories of measuring echoes.